Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good morning. Welcome to New Books in History podcast, part of the New Books Network. My name is Krzysztof Odyniec, and my guest today is Dr. Sasha Pak. Sasha Pak is Associate Professor of History at the University of Buffalo. He studies modern Europe, Spain and Portugal, and the Mediterranean, and transnational and political history. His new book, The Deepest Border, considers the Strait of Gibraltar as a borderland or border zone. Dr. Pak integrates a range of sources, military intelligence files, public health reports, consular correspondence, and travel diaries from Spain, France, Morocco, and Gibraltar to examine how sovereignty operates on the periphery and how borders are constructed and maintained and the enduring legacies of imperialism and colonialism. So thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Pak. Good morning in California, and I suppose good evening in Paris.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you tell us, what is Gibraltar? How is it important? How did it happen? Your book starts with the Treaty of Utrecht after the War of Spanish Succession, but maybe you can tell us a bit about its geology and geography before, and then move into the politics.
Absolutely. Well, of course, Gibraltar refers to a large rock that stands about 1,400 feet high that is connected the southern portion of the Iberian Peninsula and is connected by a small strip of land that's about a mile long and a few hundred feet wide. So it's not quite an island, although if you look at it from a distance, it almost looks like an island that's sitting out there in the middle of the Strait of Gibraltar, which itself is only about 8 miles wide, 8 to 10 miles wide, depending on where you are. Of course, it separates Europe from Africa, Spain from Morocco, if you like, the first world from the third world, the historic domains of Christianity and those of Islam and so forth. So it very much is an important world border, and to see it is very impressive because you see it right in front of your eyes. And the most prominent feature of the landscape is the Rock of Gibraltar, which, as you mentioned, fell under control of the English in 17. Well, it was captured by the English in 1704, but eventually, with the Treaty of Utrecht in 1713, it is formally given over to Britain. Now, the book is about many things, and Gibraltar is only one strand. The actual British colony of Gibraltar is actually one strand of the whole story, but it's an important strand because it is the British Empire that turns the Strait into a geographical feature that has real geopolitical significance, first in the British conquest of the Mediterranean, if you want to call it that, the British-French rivalry in the Mediterranean, and then later on down after the opening of the Suez Canal in the 1860s, becomes a kind of a junction in the global thoroughfare that links the North Atlantic with India and the Pacific. So that, as a result, has an impact on the kind of much more local scale, in the sense that this once relatively remote kind of society, or two societies, really, one on the southern tip of Iberia and the other in the northern part of Morocco, suddenly become become linked to this to the world beyond, and they acquire this extremely important geopolitical position, while at the same time also becoming more connected to one another, and at the same time being sort of relatively poor and remote. So there you have it. That's the Rock of Gibraltar, which sort of is the linchpin that kind of connects, I think, the story together in many ways.
So let me ask you. You really take a 19th century look at this longer story, and I think that's maybe because, as you said, the British really come into the Mediterranean and become such a powerful empire, far far more so than other empires in before. And from an earlier sort of early modern Spanish point of view, it's a Spanish possession, but then everything changes technologically. This horrible, unending problem with cholera that we see throughout the whole story, and I think multilateral, just the fact that it's not only Spain and Morocco, but now it's the British, and now it's the French, and now it's eventually, I'm sure the Americans, they're not big, but they're there, and you talk about a multilateral regional order in the Hispanic African borderland. So that's sort of both like two-sided and many faceted. Is that unique to the 19th century?
And into the first part of the 20th. Yes, absolutely. I think you said that. Well, we often tend to think of the second half of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century in terms of this era of European empire and colonialism and settlement, this kind of outward expansion of Europe. And of course, in many ways, that's accurate. But at the same time, I caution against looking at the Strait of Gibraltar as this kind of horizon for European expansionism, because, first of all, nobody was particularly interested in conquering Morocco and colonizing Morocco for its own sake. Eventually, Morocco does become a protectorate of the French with a Spanish section in the north. But that's really kind of auxiliary to the French colony in Algeria. And at the same time, Spain and the Spanish, who of course lose the vestiges of their American empire in 1898 at the hands of the United States, the Spanish don't particularly think of themselves as imperialists. They think of themselves very much as being colonized as well by this situation. The fact that the British control this strategically vital Rock of Gibraltar, which sits on what they consider to be their territory, by the terms of a treaty, this Treaty of Utrecht of 1713, which they feel the British never really took seriously and never really abided by the terms of. And so the Spanish feel themselves to be colonized. So yes, they do establish a colonial protectorate in Morocco, a very small portion of essentially the northern sliver of French Morocco. But it's very much also the story of a kind of cultivation of a sort of colonial solidarity between the Spanish and the Moroccans, in a common effort to try to liberate themselves from Anglo-French control. This may sound a little bit far-fetched because, of course, the Spanish did take a very kind of paternalistic attitude toward the Moroccans, and they certainly did establish a colony. And this is maybe only half sincere when they talk about a kind of Hispano-Moroccan brotherhood and so forth, or Hispano-Moroccan solidarity. But there is something to it, and you can see that very clearly, especially from 1936 forward, sort of at the toward the latter part of our period, when you have a military revolt in Spain that touches off the Spanish Civil War, and some of the most enthusiastic followers and supporters of the rebellion, which is comes to be led by Francisco Franco, who had become the dictator of Spain for many decades, some of the most exuberant supporters turn out to be Moroccans, who support him largely because they think that he will liberate them from the sort of French liberal Republican, perhaps atheist yoke.
That is amazing. We don't often think about Spain that way, at least since I studied earlier Spain. It's just this, you know, great empire. But then you really make that case there early on in your book that 180,000 Spaniards lived in North Africa. And unlike these other Europeans living in their own conclaves and concessions, they mixed among the people. Some of them took Muslim wives. And I read elsewhere that Franco built the first mosque in Ceuta, you know, since the expulsion of the Moors and the Jews.
Sure.
400, whatever, many hundreds of years earlier. So that's a really new way to look at Spain. And maybe you could tell us, because, you know, as I was reading along with your book, I really rediscovered the total miserable chaos that 19th century Spain was, politically speaking, and also the poverty. So what's going on in Spain between, you know, after Napoleon and before Franco? What is that?
Yeah, 19th century Spain is, you could characterize it in many ways, but I think a mess is probably not a bad way to start. There is the French Revolution, and the peninsular, what's known as the Peninsular War to oust Napoleon, seems to give this kind of patina of national unity, because the goal is to expel the French. But underneath that are very different views about why the French should be expelled. And so that legacy continues throughout the 19th century. You have liberals who, want to bring, see Spain, follow the trajectory of a country like Britain, or and you even have a republican movement that develops, and they are revolutionaries. And then you have traditionalists, traditional Catholics, monarchists, and so forth, who see things very differently. And these two groups do not, well, actually there are many groups, but you could sort of boil it down to those two. It's more complicated than that, of course, but they are essentially in cycles of civil wars, of military coups, and so forth, pretty much throughout the entire 19th century. Things cool off in the last couple of decades, but then you have the rise of, sort of revolutionary anarchism and socialism, as you see elsewhere in Europe as well, which is in many ways continues that struggle, which then explodes in 1936 with the Spanish Civil War. So Spain is, and of course, because you have this sort of cycle of civil wars, there's very little economic development. I mean, there's some, but you certainly don't have the kind of takeoff that you have in other European countries. So that by 1900, Spain, outside of certain cities, Barcelona, Madrid, a few others, Bilbao, that would look recognizably modern and European to a traveler. But you also, in the vast majority of the country, you see essentially a world that, was kind of, well, a Southern European world. I mean, rather than a kind of what we would think of as a Western European world, you have lots of landless peasants working for very little, living in abject poverty for generation after generation, looking not too different from what you'd see in, say, Greece or southern Italy or something like that. And that, of course, in the southern part of Spain, right around the region I'm writing about, the kind of northern shore of the Strait of Gibraltar, that is very, that is the prominent sort of socio-historical feature, these landless peasants with very little prospect for upward mobility. And they tend to be the ones who, become kind of low-level smugglers. When I say low-level smugglers, I mean they're the sort of, the mules, the foot soldiers of these kind of vast operations of smuggling tobacco and other goods, but tobacco is really the big one. And they sort of tend to have very little attachment to the government per se. The government are the guys who chase them when they're trying to live out their livelihood for a few pesetas a day, running tobacco across a border or into the woods and so forth. You referred to shatter zones, and you get this sort of situation in which there's very little.
Could you define shatter zones for our listeners?
Well, yeah, I mean, this region sort of starts out, I argue, in the early modern period as a shatter zone, in the sense that most of the social organization, even the legal conventions and norms, the way that the society is ordered in the south of Spain and the north of Morocco, has very little to do with any kind of central authority. Most of the people living there are doing what they can to avoid any kind of connection or association with their governments. And then this mentality is abetted by the fact that you have these little exclaves like British Gibraltar sitting there, Ceuta and Melilla, the two Spanish cities in northern Morocco, serve a similar purpose, as does the city of Tangier eventually, because it becomes an international European colony. They abet that shatter zone society because they are able to offer protection to people who are avoiding persecution by the Spanish or the Moroccan authorities, smugglers mainly at this point, but eventually, militiamen and so forth as well, because the authorities in Melilla or the authorities in Gibraltar have an interest in protecting them. They're integral to the economies of those exclaves, essentially. And they will become integral to the sort of imperial projection of power of those exclaves. So it's a place where these little exclaves actually wind up exerting a kind of imperial influence far beyond their size and far beyond the kind of military strength that's concentrated there.
So that really seems like the story of state formation everywhere else, or at least to the north, because, as we historians often probably say, the normal life for most people throughout history was sort of chaos, local power, no sense of any kind of national identity. The fact that many nations did not exist as we think of them, or national languages, or any idea who's in the capital or what is the flag, or you're supposed to go to public school. None of that existed at that time. And it's slowly forming in these, modern European cities. But of course, the south of Spain, the south of Italy are getting left behind. The Wild West in the United States are getting left behind. But as it's sort of taking shape in France and England, it's not taking place in Spain at the same clip because of all the political turmoil. So now you have this shatter zone, border zone, where only local power is effective. And you also describe so many very clever political entrepreneurs and brigands and smugglers. I think you call them slipstream potentates. Ed, could you tell us who are these really colorful, remarkable characters? And I have a list of a few of them that maybe you can tell us about, and how they managed to negotiate a place where no central authority had much to say about anything, except for, you're under arrest and give me some taxes.
Yeah, right. And in fact, I mean, and even then, what makes the situation so, so completely zany is that this you're under arrest for smuggling tobacco by the central authority. Well, this fellow will just go to a local judge or a mayor or whoever who's actually enriched himself through the same sort of smuggling trade and get a pardon. Or sometimes even a priest. And so actually, you know, they might even not understand that what they're doing is at all illegal. And so you've got these enterprises, and some of them, like I said, tobacco smuggling was the big one in southern Spain. But you would have in the north of Morocco, it tended to be more kind of classic brigandage, which, you know, would be, you know, bandits, robbers, you know, highway robbers. And that kind of thing. A few who built up large empires, you could say, Juan March, who would die the richest man in Spain in 1962, had something like 40,000 people on his payroll, many of whom were actually government employees, Spanish government employees whom he was paying off. But, you know, tobacco growers, merchants, and runners, and so forth, and he winds up being building up this massive wealth, and he's able to do this because there are so many borders in this region, so he's able to sort of set up his operations. Just behind, say, the French line, in Algeria, he does a lot of operations out of Gibraltar, flying the British flag because he's able to register, you know, register his vessels in Gibraltar and so forth. So no one can get to him. And the minute that Spanish, French, and British authorities decide we're going to go after Juan March, which happens a couple times in the first part of the 20th century. We're going to go after this smuggling empire because he's not, because we're losing millions of pesetas in revenue because he's violating the terms of the monopoly. They can get him if they cooperate, but most of the time they don't cooperate. Most of the time he's able to sort of, like I say, as you know, I use the term slipstream potentate. Well, he's this sort of becomes a potentate by riding in the slipstream. That is the sort of area behind an empire. If you've ever ridden a bicycle behind a truck, you know what that is. You know, you don't have any wind resistance. So you can sort of hide behind an empire until build power. And if that empire sort of turns on you, well, you can kind of usually use your power to get away from it and ride behind a different empire for a little while. And Juan March does this. Another figure who does this is Ahmed Mohamed Raisouni, who is a Moroccan brigand in the north who, you know, builds up a sizable army. The Sultan at first is sort of jealous of his power. This is a region of Morocco that the Sultan's never really been very effective at controlling. And Raisouni does an effective job at controlling it. So the Sultan tries to bring him in, tries to flatter him, gives him, in 1904, awards him Tangier, the city of Tangier, says, you know, you'll become the Caid of Tangier, which is essentially the governor of Tangier. But this is a time there's a lot of European settlement there. And he's, you know, kind of commits this reign of extortion and terror in the city of Tangier, and the Europeans are not happy with it. So eventually they pressure the Sultan to arrest him, which they do, but they can't hold him. He manages to escape. During the First World War, the Germans supply him, the Spanish supply him, and he conducts statecraft in the way you would expect any state to conduct it. You know, he changes alliances, he makes treaties, and of course he has a very large following. And eventually, you know, he's captured, but he's captured only at the hands of another slipstream potentate, Abdelkrim, who, you know, leads a rebellion that's often described as a kind of kind of proto-nationalist Moroccan rebellion against the Spanish in the 1920s, although I think it's really better described as another sort of attempt at, you know, at kind of building a non-sovereign power base in, you know, through a very similar set of mechanisms, sort of exploiting borders, exploiting rivalries between the sovereign powers to build up this kind of local power in the middle ground.
He's such an interesting case, the Abdelkrim at the end, where you describe his the Rifian crisis, or this war that goes on between Spain and Krim for 6 or 7 years. And I also get the impression that he can exploit the language of state formation and nationalism and these things, whereas the other guys feel much more like you know, gangsters, or as you say, the last of the Barbary pirates elsewhere. How does he play with that, and how does that work in this time, you know, of a very early 20th century nationalism happening everywhere?
Yeah, well, the Rif, which is the kind of mountainous region of northern Morocco, which, you know, is famously rebellious. I mean, they resisted Arabization, you know, dating to the 8th century. They resisted the Moroccan Sultan's rule. They resisted the Spanish protectorate. You know, they're sort of famously rebellious. And often Abdelkrim is sort of taken as a figure who's actually modern. He's not understood as part of this long sort of supposedly eternal cycle of Rifi rebelliousness. He's a new kind of modern figure who is in the employ of the Spanish during World War I and decides that, he learns from observing the Germans and the Spanish that the Rifis could build a kind of a nationalist movement, a kind of a state building movement. He wants to integrate the tribes that have been sort of warring with one another. He wants to, you know, form a kind of Rifi nation, which might eventually become, come to include all of Morocco. So he's often held up as this kind of modernizing proto-nationalist leader who doesn't quite succeed because the Spanish and French finally defeat him. They defeat him they have to use incendiary bombs. They have to use chemical warfare and so forth, but they are able to defeat him by 1927. But until that, you know, for 6 or 7 years, he does, give hope that maybe, you know, Morocco can gain its independence. The thing is, when I took a closer look at it, I came to conclude that, I mean, yes, he certainly did have this proto-nationalist kind of rhetoric, and he sort of did imagine building up a Rifi state. But at the same time, he also exploited many of these same assets of his region. The fact that the Spanish and the French had this terrible rivalry, so he could play them off of one another, and he could, and the British for that matter as well. So he could, when he knew that the French and the Spanish were involved in heated negotiations over the status of Tangier, he could sort of convince the French that he could weaken the Spanish position by doing this and that. He could get supplies in from smugglers in Gibraltar, convince them that if they invest in his movement, that it will pay dividends, that they'll, you know, they could, just like any kind of investment, they can invest in his movement. So he was able to get financing through the financial networks at Gibraltar, and so forth. And this actually was quite effective in a movement that militarily shouldn't have been that effective in terms of its, you know, in terms of, if you sort of compare it militarily with the Spanish, it shouldn't have stood a chance, but he managed to kind of do it through these essentially kind of slipstream potentate kind of methods that had been tried and true in the region for at least a century.
So is this image that I have, that because they're far from anybody who has power and attention span to come in and lay down the law, they're far from Madrid, they're far from Paris, they're far from London, they're far from Istanbul, that it is sort of this Wild West gangster land that also, I think, appears in popular culture. I think about Casablanca, which is in Morocco, the movie. And I think about Carmen, the opera, where the soldier deserts and runs off to the mountains with the gypsies and the smugglers. And I think about this wonderful passage you have about the children's game, where they don't play hide and seek in La Linea. They play contrabandistas y carabineros. They play smugglers and sentries. And then just to add one more, I think about the planet Tatooine, which was filmed in Tunisia, where everything is so far from the center of the galactic empire and you can do whatever you want. Is that a fair or is that a ridiculous romantic?
Well, it's not too far off. I mean, I think, you know, Carmen obviously is quite romanticized and Tatooine, I can't help but think that they got the idea for Tatooine by having visited these places and sort of seen, the way they operate. But I think what's interesting about this particular place is that superimposed on that world is this geopolitical struggle that's deeply consequential for the British Empire, for the French Empire, and indeed that Germany wants to the Germans don't really necessarily want to control the Strait of Gibraltar, but they certainly see an opportunity in both world wars to disrupt the British and French positions there as a way to open up a new front in both of those wars. So, later on you have the Pan-Arab movement led by Nasser. You have the Soviet Union, and indeed you also have the United States that are also there. And so you have this geopolitical struggle that's become superimposed on this a world that is not accustomed to this kind of attention. And I think it creates some sort of interesting characters like the ones I've been discussing, certainly, but also an interesting dynamic that helps us understand the current situation there, which is a situation that one hears a lot about in the news of, immigration, of course, people wanting to leave Africa and get to Europe by any means they can. And also over the last couple of decades, thinking about about jihadist violence and that kind of thing. I think that if we don't have a sort of a deeper sense of the more recent history of that border, we just kind of go back to, we just sort of default back to the sort of Christians and Muslims paradigm, or whether it's a clash of civilizations paradigm or a multiculturalist paradigm or whatever. But there's so much more complexity to it. And I think that looking at the history, from in the modern period, not as a history just purely of colonialism, but as also as a borderland history, gives it a much richer picture than I think what we might assume there just by thinking about it in terms of your Carmen or your Tatooine or these places that that time forgot.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. nbn50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, okay, let's talk more about that, the convivencia aspect, the different cultures living together, because I think that's such a wonderful and much more positive aspect of this, in addition to sort of like gangsterland, you know, shenanigans. In the crown colony of Gibraltar, there were Britons and Spaniards and Portuguese and Majorcans and Jews and Genoese, and same thing in the Spanish city of Ceuta. I mentioned that Franco, who is such a, you know, Catholic conservative authoritarian figure, built a mosque, and you know his name is still there, enshrined as the promoter of, you know, monotheism in this secular atheist, you know, time. Or, you know, what's going on there? And we talked about how the Spaniards are mixing. Well, that goes so much counter to the traditional idea of Spaniards who are expelling Muslims, expelling Jews, and trying to consolidate their homogeneity. But not so, not here. And maybe tell us what you've discovered about that, because I find that to be a very uplifting or, you know, exciting, maybe not uplifting, but exciting.
Yeah, well, it can be uplifting. I think the side that often surprises people is the fact that Franco sort of, you know, is an admirer, a great admirer of Hitler, a would-be ally of Hitler's and Mussolini's. Franco, who, you know, presents himself in Spain as a kind of a Catholic nationalist crusader. Well, his movement originates in the Spanish colony of Morocco. That's where, you know, the army is assembled and they kind of invade from across the strait using German and Italian planes to, you know, airlift their supplies onto the Iberian Peninsula. They, you know, they need Moroccan mercenaries, first of all. So, you know, but they're also, you know, appealing to this idea that the main threat to the world in 1936 is atheism, is liberalism, is communism. And so, yes, Catholics or Christians and Muslims have had at it in the past, but we can also draw on this very romanticized memory of Al-Andalus, medieval Iberia, in which Muslims and Christians and Jews, incidentally, did live together. I mean, to call it a multicultural society is anachronistic, but they certainly did live together. And the idea was, you know, if we respect differences, if we make sure that there isn't too much mixing in terms of romance, you know, I mean, they were very vigilant actually about making sure that, you know, Christian women and Muslim men and vice versa didn't get involved. And there were very few cases of that. If we can set those boundaries, we can actually live together fruitfully in terms of trade, in terms of, you know, if we respect each other's religion. And so that was, you know, that was the idea. And it did get a lot of people on board, you know, on board. And granted, it was for essentially, I'm sorry, I know you wanted to interrupt, but I just didn't finish the thought. You know, and it did actually provide, it winds up providing 80,000 troops for Franco's army.
There's one point where you say, yes, absolutely, they are avoiding hybridization, which is this, you know, intermarriage. But other place you say that Spaniards did have Moorish wives. And did you have a sense of which one, you know, I'm guessing now that the intermarriage is the aberration, not the norm.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. If you go back many centuries, you have untold numbers of Spaniards who disappeared into Barbary to find adventure. You know, people who were wanted or were deserting military service or who were, you know, owed money or whoever, who just fled Spain and went to Morocco or Algeria to just find their fortunes, and we just don't know what happened to them. Then in the 19th century, you have a lot of Spanish immigration. There was a lot of poverty in Spain, so a lot of Spaniards went to French Algeria to find work, and many of them, a certain number of them, you know, wind up eventually converting to Islam and so forth. We don't; it's hard to say how many, but it's certainly not a majority. But you know, some do. It is with the establishment of the Spanish protectorate, and then particularly with Franco coming along, where they say no. if we're going to make this work, we really have to respect these divisions, and we have to respect pious Christians, pious Muslims fighting side by side against the evils of the modern world, which are this atheism, liberalism, socialism, and so forth. That's the message. And it's a message you sort of summon the sort of medieval legacy of, you know, the Spanish warlord El Cid being the kind of the example that Franco seems to be following, who leads Christian and Muslim troops at the same time in the 11th century. So, you know, and again, these are sort of romanticized visions of these figures, but it's a way to kind of convincingly say, yes, I'm a Catholic crusader, but Islam, the true Islam, is on my side. And this cultivates a kind of a certain Moroccan nationalism, as long as it can be directed against the French and not the Spanish.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And especially in that 19th century sort of Walter Scott idea where everybody's on crusade together and every noble knight is in disguise anyway.
Oh, yeah.
They're all on the same, you know, there's so many noble Moors and noble Saracens fighting with, you know, whatever, noble crusaders. And that fits. Not to mention the El Cid movie that came out when Franco was still alive.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm sorry to have interrupted. Did I derail your thought?
No, not at all.
Yeah. Okay. So that's remarkable too. And I think that no matter what the outside world says rhetorically, they're going to do their own thing, which is a pragmatic thing where I'm really interested in my neighbors, not in what somebody says in the capital. And my neighbor is from this group and I'm from this group, but we get together and we get along. And maybe we're smuggling tobacco together, or maybe evading the taxes, or, you know. One more character that appears throughout the century is cholera. And that does not go away. It's almost like the bubonic plague of, you know, the 19th century. It just keeps coming back and keeps coming back and kills a third of the people and kills a third of the people. Talk about that. That's because that's something we've totally forgotten.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, I think the reason cholera first comes up, you know, it's often you'll see it, you know, come up in these travel narratives and so forth. And we went to Damascus and there was cholera, so we had to leave, kind of thing. And it just sort of appears and you really don't know why, but cholera is a classic 19th century disease. It doesn't, you know, it didn't, you know, it's existed since, you know, as long as we know. I mean, it's existed since for thousands of years. Apparently originated in South Asia, but it can't survive on sailing vessels long enough to spread, because the sailing vessels, you know, just on wind sail, you know, just don't go fast enough. But with the steamship, cholera could actually survive a trip from India to Europe. And so when people are able to get around the seas faster, cholera starts spreading. And so the 19th century, and people can't really figure out what causes it. It lives in water, it turns out. But there's this kind of, you know, there's this debate among epidemiologists in the 19th century. Are they, you know, is it contagious or is it environmental? And it sort of seems to be both. But in any case, you know, because it seems to attack people who live in places where there's a lot of standing water, places that are sort of foul smelling and with poor sewage evacuation. But at the same time, it's obviously contagious. So there was this debate. Well, which is it? Turns out it's both, because it lives in the water. So if you know, you have wet towels, say, on a ship, and then those towels are offloaded and introduced into a city, well, so is cholera. And so where you have more standing water, there's more time for the cholera, more places where the cholera can spread. The reason this is significant is because quarantine is one method of controlling cholera. Another is improving the urban landscape, getting rid of standing water, improving sewage systems, and so forth. And the problem with quarantining is that it's very deleterious to trade. I mean, if you require ships to sit for 15 days in harbor before they can offload their goods, a lot of people die, a lot of people go hungry. It's an impediment to trade, whereas, you know, and so And it can also become a kind of political tool as well. And that's what the Spanish attempted to do, to try to, you know, starve out Gibraltar on a couple of occasions, to use cholera as a pretext to starve out Gibraltar. But what winds up kind of gaining more currency by the latter part of the 19th century is, you know, urban sanitation movement. So that's where you see cities that, you know, had been sort of foul places like Tangier, a number of cities on the southern coast of Spain, Malaga, not to mention Ceuta and Melilla, that are sort of improved. And they become open for settlement. And indeed, in the case of Tangier, a kind of nascent tourism industry. It's sort of like the Sun Belt, you know, avant la lettre. You have, you have lots of people going down to these places. So that's really also, it's an element of colonialism as well, where people settle there, and that, again, it reinforces this kind of mixing. And then to a place like Tangier, when Europeans start settling there, people with a certain amount of money start investing there, it attracts Moroccans to the city as well. And there's a kind of, yes, it's a colonial city. So we're sort of trained to think that that's, there's a kind of an ethical problem with that. But at the same time, there was... It was a kind of a society where there was a good deal more mixing of different kinds of people than what you would see after decolonization.
So great. Let's talk more about tourism. And I just want to say that cholera is such a great example because it shows how technology can make things worse before it actually makes things better. Yeah, and one of the other things that happened with the advent of steam is that Gibraltar becomes this coaling station, which is not as well paid as whatever they were before. And so there's economic depression. And then tourism comes along, and that changes a lot. So maybe say a bit about tourism did not exist 200 years ago, and it sure is a big deal now. I was in Gibraltar as a tourist when I was in college back.
All right.
I think last century, maybe. I don't know. Maybe not. But,
yeah,
but,
right.
But I was there, and, you know, you go up the rock, and you buy some snacks, and then there's a bunch of monkeys, which are very aggressive and funny. How does tourism transform this part of the world?
Well, very early on, actually, Gibraltar isn't really one of the centers of tourism until a bit later. Certainly, you know, Tangier, it's a place where there's less tourism today, proportionately, but 1900, it was, this was the future. There was all kinds of investment. That's where much of the transport infrastructure was down there was built to attract tourists. The railroad industry, the main rail companies were the ones who built the luxury hotels that are down there. It's interesting on that level. I mean, it has a significance on that level. It brought people seeking a more comfortable kind of lifestyle, who weren't just, not just adventurers, but people who, you know, just wanted to escape. You know, maybe they had tuberculosis or something, and they wanted to escape, the clogged, cold, damp industrial cities of England, and spend the winter in Tangier or Algiers, in French Algeria, similar kind of thing. And then when that happens, it is also it's an invitation for brigands as well. And so that, you know, actually created that dynamic. And one of the, you know, Raisuni's rise, who I mentioned earlier, the brigand in northern Morocco, kind of got his rise, really got attention. He kidnapped Moroccans all the time. And there wasn't a whole lot to be gained. But if you start kidnapping European tourists here and there, you can really make some ransom money. And so that was a big part of his rise to power as well, was, you know, going after.
Tell that story. Tell the story how he kidnaps a Times correspondent and then they become lifelong friends.
Then they become lifelong friends. Yes, absolutely. Well, it's the Stockholm syndrome, right? Like where you start to have sympathy for your captor after you're in captivity. It was kind of a surprising story, but actually Harris, this figure who's, you know, kidnapped and spends a few weeks in Raisuni's captivity, but he Raisuni even keeps you know, Raisuni's a good Muslim. He wouldn't keep alcohol on hand. He certainly wouldn't keep a Christian Bible on hand, but he does because he captures Europeans every once in a while and he wants to be hospitable. So he makes sure that they have, you know, wine to drink and a Bible to read. And so, you know, so a lot of what we know about Raisuni actually comes from Harris's account of his captivity there. And Harris is always kind of sympathetic to him and sort of admires him. And he eventually gets something like £25,000 ransom for releasing Harris and is made on that occasion is when he is actually made a Qaid of Tangier position, which he's able to hold for a couple of years anyway. And through that position, he enriches himself a good deal more by, you know, selling property titles and all the things, you know, I mean, essentially, you know, he's a gangster, but he's a gangster with political power now. So he enriches himself that way as well.
Well, you know what? I think that is fantastic. The journalism aspect and some of the travel diaries you found. I loved following along in your footnotes, and I would often go down these little tunnels. So I started reading Alexander Slidell McKenzie, who's this American officer. And I think he does a grand tour in Spain for a year in the 1820s or, you know, equivalent. And just his remarkable 19th century romantic descriptions of this, you know, he has great admiration for the British. He makes a lot of fun of the Spanish character, and he has a really distasteful dislike for the Jews, which is, you know, hard to read, but he's an excellent writer and he gets you into the mind of those people. And you have just citation after citation of these characters. How did you find all these sources? How did you enjoy reading them? And, I imagine you probably assign these things left and right now to your undergraduates. Or tell me about your sources.
Yeah, well, you know, I use a range of sources. The travel narratives tend to be my favorites. Like, I do enjoy reading them. How I found them, you know, I don't remember how I found that one. It so happens that the Spaniards, particularly, less so the Moroccans, but the Spaniards. Spanish historians have always been very interested in how they're perceived, how Spain is perceived. So there's a lot of literature on that, on, you know, perceptions of Spain by romantic travelers and perception. So, you know, you can start looking at those works and seeing the bibliography and kind of, so it wasn't that hard to find those. Of course, digging into them and really mining them for the kinds of things I was looking for was then, a lot of work, but it was work that I enjoyed very much. And then they tend to be more interested actually in the foreign gaze. That's sort of a Spanish national obsession in some respects. But then also finding, diaries of Spanish journalists, which I had to do a little bit more digging for. Unfortunately, I don't have Arabic skills and I don't think I ever will at this point. So I wasn't able to read anything in Arabic, but there was a certain amount that I was able to find in translation into French that I was able to get through. And then additionally, I used military archives, which I find to be a wonderful source for this type of thing. A lot of them contain sort of what amount to travel narratives as well, at least kind of, reports by intelligence gatherers that are just giving a lot of detail about whatever they can learn. So in some respects, they kind of look like travel narratives in a way. And then your typical kind of consular reports and that kind of thing were also fairly helpful. Another source that I used, which kind of departs from that kind of thing, were a few court cases, a few legal cases, which reveal a bit about what the terms border cooperation or cross-border cooperation were particularly between the Gibraltar and the Spanish authorities.
Well, it really is a marvelous bibliography that you have. And I should have said this right on the outset, that this book is very readable. There's no, you know, historian's jargon in it. You can just go right through it, and then the footnotes are a delight. They lead you into all kinds of interesting things.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because the first draft had a lot, and I tried to peel it away with each revision, and I think that's kind of a good practice for historians in general. You know, you need the jargon. We need the jargon amongst ourselves, I think, because it's shorthand for what we do, and we understand what we mean, and it's a way, you know, it helps us theorize and think theoretically. But with each successive draft, I think it's good to strip away and really tell your story with clarity in a way that anyone could understand.
So I think the last question I'll ask you is probably the one that people think about first, is Gibraltar as a military installation. It is a rock, and I don't think it has been taken by force at any point, or you can correct me, but the times it's changed hands, it's somebody was away and somebody snuck in and somebody tricked somebody else. And people could hold up there. There was a one siege you write about that lasted 4 years and did not succeed. And I'm sure you have a lot of military sources describing the day-to-day life. I read elsewhere that the most flogged man in the British Empire was posted in Gibraltar. He's a drummer who was flogged 30,000 times in the course of his, like 30,000 lashes, I should say. But I mean, it just sounds like a severe place to be. And I don't think anybody has ever conquered it, except for, of course, James Bond in The Living Daylights.
It was not a great assignment to be stationed there, which, you know, and same for the Spaniards on the other side, which is why, you know, they sort of assumed that part of it was collecting bribes was maybe a kind of a mitigating factor. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's very much, you know, the life there, and, you know, largely because of the cholera. It got better. I mean, it got better by the 20th century. You've been there. You know, it's not a horrible place anymore, but I think for much of the 19th century, it very much was. Not very much space. You know, this isthmus that connects it to the mainland, you know, really became, you know, a place where, you know, gardening was, you know, fertilized with untreated sewage. And that was the, you know, that was the source of fresh food. So you get the idea.
And today you say it's, today's quite comfortable. So strange things are going on there. They have casinos and financial institutions. They have internet gambling. What is Gibraltar in 2019?
Well, under Franco, in the 1960s, there was really an attempt by the Spanish to take it back. And the strategy for doing that was essentially to blockade it, to close the border. The British sort of thought they would never close the border because the towns on the other side were so dependent on, you know, working in Gibraltar, you know, labor, all the employment opportunities there and so forth. But they did it for 13 years, from 1969 to 1982. Eventually opened it up when the Spanish were trying to get into NATO and so forth in the 80s. But, you know, that cross-border sort of single sort of cross-border community that had formed over the course of that century between about 1850 and, you know, 1960s kind of was no longer there. And Gibraltar sort of became deterritorialized, you know. Now it became a center of, you know, finance and, you know, internet gambling and all these things that are sort of unregulated. Now with the whole issue with Brexit, is so complicated that it gives me a headache to even think about. So I won't go into it, but Gibraltar is exempt from any of the financial regulations that, that the EU has, you know, imposed elsewhere. And so it sort of sits out in the middle of the ocean, in a sense, even though it's right there on the edge of Europe.
Remarkable. Well, those are all my questions. Is there anything we've forgotten to talk about?
No, this was wonderful. I appreciate your questions, and I don't really have anything more I'm yearning to add. So,
well, I can't thank you enough. You've really changed my view. As a 16th century Spanish historian, I think of the Gibraltar as the, you know, pillars of Hercules, and that went from the barrier to the Atlantic to sort of the gateway to the New World for Charles V.
Yeah.
It appears on the flag of Spain, but you've given me this whole new way to think about it in 19th century. And this is a wonderful book. I recommend it to historians and non-historians and lay people and certainly undergraduates and graduate students working on your orals list. So thank you again, Dr. Pack, and thank you so much for speaking with us today on the New Books in History podcast.
Well, thanks very much, Christoph. It was a real pleasure.